Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Sovereign Citizens. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. There is a strong chance that you may have come across the guys that I'm going to talk about tonight. This, well, movement, if you will. Especially if your ear takes you to the sounds of the MAGA commentary, Pizzagate conspiracists, end-time preppers, and other right-wing talking groups. If you're online and part of the internet community, you will almost certainly have heard about them. And whilst they are not a cult per se, they certainly are a group of conspiracists and alternate belief propagators. I'm talking about sovereign citizens. What the hell is a sovereign citizen, Jamie Black? Well, I'm glad you asked. It's a loose group of people who have risen in prominence and visibility over the last two decades. You can mostly thank the internet for that. I find the movement quite interesting on the whole, not because I agree with their points, their cause, or how they interpret reality, but because of their mindset, their will, and their psychology. So for those of you who have not heard about the Sovereign Citizen movement, let's dig in. In very diluted terms, a sovereign citizen is someone who believes they do not have to abide by the rules of the law of the country in which they reside, because they do not submit to being a quote-unquote member of the country where they live. Just because they were born in a particular nation does not automatically mean that they are citizens of said country, they protest. Specifically, these individuals are a loose group of anti-government activists, provoking litigants, tax and legal protesters, and conspiracy theorists. These citizens exist in countries which operate a common law legal system, such as the United Kingdom, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. This is the legal system which was created and developed in the United Kingdom over many centuries, and through the British Empire was shared and adopted amongst its former colonies, and it's still operated today. Misinterpretations of common law writs, laws and statuses has meant that sovereign citizens hold their own unique pseudo-legal beliefs. They believe that their interpretation of laws and their false understanding of laws make them not to be subject to any government statuses unless they wholly consent to them. It's a form of resistance through pseudo-intellectual and overblown legalese arguments. Sovereign citizens first appeared in the United States in the early 1970s, and from there the movement has grown substantially globally, particularly through Commonwealth and Western countries, although it was the emergence of the internet which allowed their message and belief to spread, which saw the most significant rise in their followers. The Sovereign Citizen movement has been cited by the Federal Bureau of Investigation as a, quote, anti-government extremist movement, unquote. This is due in part to so many of them engaging in armed confrontation with law enforcement over the years. The FBI further labels the individuals as misguided countrymen who believe that even though they are physically resident in the country that they dwell, they are under the misconception that they are separate, or sovereign, from the United States in legal standing. Surveys of law enforcement officers across the United States in 2014 identified that the risk of terrorism from the sovereign citizen movement was considered by police officers to be higher than the risk from any other group. This included Islamic terrorists, neo-Nazis, militias, racist skinheads, and radical environmentalists. In 2015, the Australian New South Wales Police Force identified sovereign citizens as a potential terrorist threat. Sovereign citizens firmly and often aggressively believe that law courts have no legal jurisdiction over the people, and also that certain procedures and processes, such as writing specific phrases on bills they do not want to pay, and by utilizing legal language loopholes, can make them immune to government laws and regulations. They also consider taxation as illegal and reject social security, driver's licenses, and vehicle registration. You may have seen Sovereign Citizen YouTube videos, which are commonly released through law enforcement body cam footage as a reminder that these beliefs are not accepted by the police or governmental bodies. These videos involve court cases, traffic stops, law enforcement altercations, and more serious incidents against authority in general. In viewing these videos, you will quickly notice that a lot of these sovereign citizens will use common and consistent phraseology and faux legal statements and declarations in their defense and to support their objections. Yes, if you are new to hearing about these individuals, they may sound quite eccentric and fanatical even. But there is a methodology to their claims. A lot of said citizens will use the same terms and tactics and follow a similar and structured curriculum of defense. The movement often appeals to people who find themselves in financial or legal difficulties, or those who wish to resist perceived government oppression. It is entirely a far-right belief structure. As a result, it has grown significantly during times of economic or social crisis. Most sovereign citizens aim to avoid paying tax, abiding by laws, disregarding personal debts, or even to extract money from the federal or national governments. They understandably don't like the police very much. To be clear, from the outset, sovereign citizen arguments have no basis in law and have never been successful in court. Yet they persist. So I'm going to talk about the history of the sovereign citizen movement. I'm going to get into the weird and wacky version of national history and their conspiracy theories. I'm going to talk about why exactly they think they can get out of legal settings. And finally, I'm also going to talk about some real-world tragedies that have resulted because of their beliefs. So let's start with the history and how this movement came to be. Pre-1960s, government protest was almost unheard of in the West. The US, UK, Canada and Australia all had relatively calm, happy, accepting and cooperative citizens. The UK and United States had both had civil wars in their past, which established the rule of normality. But sovereign citizens slowly began to emerge in 1970, originating from a misinterpretation of the Posse Comitatus Act. This was Latin for force of the county. This act is a United States federal law, which was signed on June 18, 1878 by President Rutherford B. Hayes. The law limits the powers of the federal government in the use of federal military personnel to enforce domestic policies within the United States of America. The act came into law off the back of an old frontiersman idea that sheriffs had the right to create posses in order to enact frontier justice when the need would arise. They ignore the second clause of Article 6 of the US Constitution, also known as the Supremacy Clause. This clause specifically states, and is clear, in that it establishes the Constitution as the law of the land and the United States Supreme Court as the ultimate authority to interpret it. In 1971, groups within the United States began to use that group name in order to do things that weren't exactly frontier justice, although were perceived to be. The founders of the Posse originated from the Christian Identity Movement, a far-right group that began after World War II in the United States that effectively believes that Jewish people are not the actual chosen people or Israelites of God, as per the Old Testament, but instead they believe that the true chosen people of God are white Europeans because, well, racism. The roots of the sovereign citizen movement were thus strongly associated with white supremacist and anti-Semitic ideologies. The Christian Identity Movement believed that history has been secretly rewritten and hidden from the general populace in order to hide the divinity of the holy white man. This encouraged a distrust in other ethnic groups and a distrust of world governments who kept all of this a secret in the first place. The Posse Comitatus Christian Identity and other militia movements did not really overlap until the mid-1990s, although they had a small number of members in common, and the ideologies of the three fringe areas would occasionally influence each other. One of the Christian Identity members was named William Potter Gale. During the Second World War, Gale served under General MacArthur, assigned to his personal staff. In 1945, following the end of the war, Gale became an Episcopalian minister. He is commonly cited as the founder of the Posse. The Posse firmly believed that there is no legitimate government beyond the county level. The Posse took this interpretation from the Latin translation of the Posse Comitatus, i.e. the force of the county. The Posse began to encourage its members to reject all forms of higher level government and authority. Any governmental forms, driver's licenses, birth certificates, money and taxes should be rejected, they said. At that point in the early 70s, it seemed odd and eccentric to law enforcement and county officials, sure, but their numbers were too small to cause nationwide attention or panic. At least not yet. Gale's racist beliefs were far from unique at the time, but it was his innovation of utilizing a legal philosophy and pseudo-intellectual arguments about the government's illegitimacy that made him stand out, and also made many others buy into his perceived authenticity. Gale was eventually arrested in 1987 over a vast array of tax-related charges, and he eventually died just a year later while in prison. Fun fact, it later emerged that Gale was actually Jewish, which, given the whole Christian Identity thing, is kind of, well, bizarre. The Posse gained significant attention in 1983, thanks to one of their members named Gordon Carl. Now, Carl was a firm believer in the Posse group's beliefs. He wrote a letter to the IRS in 1967 and denounced them as, quote-unquote, a synagogue of Satan. In 1975, Carl started a chapter of the Posse in Texas, and just a year later made a television appearance to talk about the Posse and their activities. He left out all the racist stuff, though, to make it more palatable to the general public. Throughout the 1970s, Carl travelled all over the southern states of the US giving speeches, talks and seminars about the Posse and promoting their cause. He regularly proudly announced that he did not pay any taxes. This eventually backfired, however, when in June of 1977, Carl was sentenced to 2 years in prison for failure to file for federal income taxes. After getting out of jail, Carl left the Posse and joined what was known as the Township Movement. Carl continued to be a part of various anti-government groups and organizations, and the more he pushed and promoted them, the more suspicion with local authorities he began to accumulate. He wasn't exactly flying under the radar. And this eventually led to a couple of US Marshals following Carl to a Posse meeting. Now, even though Carl was no longer a member of the Posse, he was still closely associated with them, and the Marshals knew that he would lead them to other supporters of the movement. The Marshals followed Carl and attempted to arrest him and some close associates of his. But in the process, the situation escalated, and Carl stepped out of his vehicle and shot the US Marshals, killing them. A huge manhunt to track down Gordon Carl ensued, and the Posse, and others with those beliefs, became national news, inadvertently spreading their message on a scale much larger than they could have ever hoped. The public were intrigued. But what the hell had led to this incident? Well, that's where the Posse Comitatus first made its way into the mainstream. Law enforcement eventually found Carl in Arkansas in June 1983 and killed him. The police initially identified Carl's home address, and instead of checking if he was even at home, the SWAT team that descended on the location, a rural farmhouse, just simply fired hundreds of bullets into the building without warning. They killed Carl's dog and saturated the house with tear gas and a frenzied hail of gunfire. But Carl wasn't even home. He was hiding at another location in Arkansas, and Sheriff Matthews and some deputies entered that house unannounced through the kitchen. And as Carl emerged from behind his refrigerator, the sheriff fired a single .41 Magnum round from his 4-inch Smith & Wesson 57 revolver, which hit Carl in the head and instantly killed him. Carl also managed to fire off at least one round, however, which fatally wounded Matthews in the heart. Okay, so Carl is dead here, right? Well, Deputy Holland Fitzpatrick, hearing the gunfire, himself fired shotgun blasts into the house, accidentally striking Sheriff Matthews once again in the torso with buckshot. Him and the other officers outside were so excited to kill God and Carl that they shot the sheriff in the process. Matthews managed to crawl to a police cruiser before he collapsed, muttering his last words, quote, "I got him." After Matthews stumbled out of the house, a SWAT team, unaware that Carl was already dead, sprayed thousands of rounds at the house, turning it into Swiss cheese. The SWAT team also poured diesel fuel down the house's chimney and set it ablaze, just for good measure. Gordon Carl's burned remains were found the following day amongst what was left of the razed house. Compared to this incident, Waco was calm and restrained. As you can imagine, this made a lot of headlines, and the posse's views spread like wildfire. As the Posse Comitatus movement evolved, its members created pseudo-legal bodies that claimed to speak with the authority of, quote, natural law, and to supersede the government's legal system. Gordon Carl's death also encouraged fresh eyes to look into the cause, and it was at this point that a lot of the anti-state ideologies began to split away from the Christian identity beliefs. It morphed into an exclusively right-wing cause and dropped the religion. Due to the national news coverage, Roger Elvick, a former North Dakota farmer who had lost his farm in a bad business deal, came to prominence after he related to the ideology. Elvick had come up with a concept known as the Redemption Movement. Redemptionism, as the movement became known, was a secret way to steal money from the federal government based on a series of fraudulent actions. Elvick announced that these were methods people could obtain money from the state by simply filing the right paperwork. Elvick wrote a book to promote his theories about how to conduct his so-called redemption package. To this day, his book remains a sacred text to sovereign citizens. Elvick was the spokesman for a group called the Committee of States. One of the things that Elvick encouraged people to do was to pay for items with something he called a sight draft. A sight draft is essentially a fraudulent, fake check that is made out from Elvick's own company. Naturally, these checks would bounce if they were accepted at all, and the government, understandably, didn't like these being used very much. So eventually, Elvick was arrested on a multitude of occasions between the early 1990s and mid-2000s. He served more than a decade in jail in this time frame too. That was in addition to the 9 months in a psychiatric hospital for reasons that will become very apparent shortly. Additionally, a further tactic that Elvick promoted and eventually became the most common tactic of the SOVSITs was to commit paper terrorism. Paper terrorism is the act of targeting a person, an agency, or a business by overloading them in paperwork or filing substantial amounts of paperwork in order to place them in trouble. An example of this being the issuance of false liens against their enemy's property. These false liens are issued by a false, quote-unquote, sovereign court. This is essentially a court made up with no legal standing. A lien is a legal claim on someone else's property or asset made to secure the payment of a debt. The lien grants the creditor, or lien holder, the right to hold on to the property until the debt is settled. If the debtor defaults, the creditor can enforce the lien, potentially leading to the property's forced sale to recover the owed amount. Further examples of paper terrorism is the filing of false tax claims against their enemies. Something like this would likely go unnoticed by most people until they potentially go to buy a house. And then they discover that a stranger has taken out a $2 million lien against their property, for example. The volume of paperwork often overloads various civil systems and processes, often tying issues up in courts for years and years and costing their enemies, be it individuals or businesses, a lot of money in legal fees and time. It was these actions that would lead to the biggest and most infamous event in sovereign citizen history: the Montana Freeman standoff. The Montana Freemen were an anti-government Christian patriot militia group who were based outside the town of Jordan in Montana. The group members referred to their land as quote-unquote Justice Township. They announced that their group members were no longer under the authority of any government and that their town was a sovereign nation. This escalated in 1996 when they engaged in an armed standoff with the FBI. It started when several banks informed law enforcement that a number of people were complaining that they had sold something to a member of the Justice Township, but that they were being issued with fake checks to pay for them. These individuals were struggling to get their debts settled, so reached out for legal help. But when these individuals tried to take action against the Justice Township, a mob rule situation began on the edge of town. They claimed that they did not abide by any federal court and instead adhered to their own common law. The group took over the small town of Jordan, blocking all entry from outsiders, including law enforcement. Police tried to intervene in the situation, but they simply didn't know how to handle it. The Justice Township began holding their own mock trials, where they decided that they were going to hang state judges. They didn't actually go through with these sentences, however. And the FBI were extremely reluctant to take forceful action against the Justice Township, with the incident at Ruby Ridge still being fresh in their minds. They wanted to prevent any violence at all costs. So on June the 14th, 1996, after 81 days of negotiations, the township surrendered to authorities. 8 members of the Justice Township were convicted, with sentences for all of them totaling more than 85 years in prison. This was a huge news story at the time, and similar to the Gordon Carl incident, and it put a lot more eyes on the sovereign citizen movement. Another major incident occurred in 2018. Bruce Duquette, a sovereign citizen guru, gained national notoriety and infamy. Duquette was a business owner from Denver, Colorado. He ran a small computer repair shop. He began giving out advice and seminars to the public and informing them of how to oppose land use regulations in Castilla County. During an armed confrontation in 2014 between supporters of cattle rancher Cliven Bundy and law enforcement, Duquette was an advisor to Bundy following a 21-year legal dispute between Bundy and the United States Bureau of Land Management. Duquette, during the standoff, proclaimed himself as, quote, Superior Court Judge of the Continental United States of America, unquote. Duquette informed the police that he would convene a, quote, Citizens Grand Jury and threatened to hold a, quote, Trial with the redress of grievance, unquote, against county and other government officials. In 2018, Duquette was sentenced to 38 years in federal prison following a 2-week trial. His charges were for tax evasion, racketeering, retaliation against judges, amongst others. Charges such as these are quite common against sovereign citizens. Additionally, it's not uncommon for hostile possession, forgery, threatening public officials, bank fraud, and traffic violations to be added to the list of charges too. But let's expand on their ideologies and beliefs a little bit, because not every sovereign citizen believes the exact same thing. Opinions and ideas differ from individual to individual and from group to group. But speaking in generality, the first sovereign citizen idea is that the United States government does not formally exist. It used to exist, but then it quit existing. When exactly the cessation of the federal government occurred is one of the things that sovereign citizens disagree on. Most will say that it happened sometime during the Civil War. Others, however, affirm in the notion that the cessation happened during the creation of Washington, D.C. And the third belief is that the U.S. government ceased in 1933, when the U.S. dollar left the global gold standard and became a flat currency. When the U.S. government ceased, it stopped being a country and instead became a corporation. A corporation of Great Britain or Israel. Please bear with me, I know how this sounds. In 1878, when the District of Columbia, or Washington, D.C., was formed into a municipal corporation, they took the word, quote, corporation, from its creation statute very literally. It's from this wording and document that they claim the entire government is now actually a business. Due to this, Sovsits believe that the United States switched from a common law legal system to a commercial law legal system. In other words, the country once ran off laws and rules that were made by consensus and for the operation of its people, but now exist for the operation of a company. A lot of their legalese and faux intellectual language will include terms such as admiralty law or maritime law, because they are under the impression that the United States is effectively an international extension of Great Britain. Thus, many of their laws are interpreted to be the rule of the Admiralty, or the rule of trade over the seas maritime law. Some claim that the bar, which in the United States refers to the collective group of licensed attorneys and the process of gaining admission to that group, actually stands for, quote, British Accreditation Registry. It doesn't. Further, they will claim that the gold fringes seen on American flags in courtrooms are not just an aesthetic choice, but they actually are a subtle clue that the US is an extension of the British Royal Navy. This interpretation comes from the fact that British naval vessels historically mounted flags with such gold trim on them. The only way you can be free, sovereign citizens believe, is by opting out. Sovereign citizens claim that the United States is an evil corporate empire. They are confident that by utilizing certain legal loopholes and filing specific paperwork to the authorities, that they can essentially get out of any laws. Resisting birth certificates, driver's licenses, or social security numbers is a way that sovsits will opt out. It is the separation of self, the person from yourself, the business entity. This is known as the straw man theory. This is one of Roger Elvick's core theories. The idea is, whenever the United States left either the gold standard for the American dollar or during the Civil War, they began leveraging American individuals to other government-based monetary factors. They claim that anyone born in the United States has a financial leverage created against them by the government. It's an estimate of how much money that person could potentially make within their lifetime. That's your self-worth or value. This can be tens of thousands of dollars to millions of dollars, depending on which sovereign citizen you ask. There is a US federal bank account that the government allocates your self-worth to, and they live in hope that you will never cash in on it. Thus, when you die, the government pockets your self-worth. I guess the assumption is that the government just creates money out of thin air in that case. But a lot of sovereign citizen strategies for money schemes is to draw from the secret bank account that they are tied to without the government noticing. This is done by separating oneself from their legal entity and then drawing from that legal entity's worth, or in other words, your straw man's worth. I appreciate this can be quite difficult to follow, so please, bear with me. Sovereign citizens have arrived at this theory because often, on official government documentation within the United States, a person's name is written in all capital letters. So they will argue that if they remove the lowercase version of their name from the all capitals identity, then they have separated themselves from the United States and can therefore submit a claim for their self-worth. To be clear, no sovereign citizen has ever achieved this or succeeded in drawing down this perceived monetary fund. But other methods of separating self from your identity is by filing a trademark for your name, or by filing or financing a statement against your straw man name. Which is kind of ironic, as they are using the US legal system to claim that they are exempt from the US legal system. Oftentimes, a SOVSIT will file specific documents containing the title of Secretary of Treasury when they go to pay bills. They also fill out their social security number as all bill payees. By doing this, they expect the government to draw the money off of their self-worth fund to pay the debt. This often leads to fraud charges. A US 1099 OID form is claimed to be a secret document. You can file this document to get access to your self-worth fund. Again, it never works, and the 1099 OID form is actually a tax form that documents payments made to the IRS by an individual or a business that typically isn't the submitter's employer. Further, by simply writing on official documents in red ink or signing the form with a thumbprint, well, this is used in order to end legal contracts a lot of the time. By filing official paperwork with red ink or a thumbprint, you are allegedly telling the government that you no longer want to be part of their corporation. For some reason, in a lot of these theories, the post office is always used as an official mediation in the government's true power. Thus, in a lot of the documentation they file, there will be stamps attached, as a sort of secret nod to the government, thus allowing the form to go through to the correct channels. Sovereign citizens' legal theories reinterpret elements of the Constitution of the United States through selective reading of law dictionaries. In particular, they use an outdated and now obsolete version of Black's Law Dictionary. Additionally, they use alternative interpretation of state rulings or specific capitalization and incorporate other details from a variety of sources. Some of these sources include the Uniform Commercial Code, the Articles of Confederation, the British Magna Carta, the Bible, and foreign treaties. Most sovereign citizens consider county sheriffs as being the most powerful law enforcement officers in the country, and will often request their attendance during a traffic stop. They perceive the county sheriff to have superior authority over any federal agent, elected official, or other local law enforcement officials. It's when they request these sheriffs that they really let loose with their legalese and faux intellectual and practiced law speak. This is an attempt to try and outsmart the government or law enforcement by demonstrating that they know more about their rights and the law than they do. For example, if you refer to yourself as David Jones, then that is who you are, because that is your government-assigned name and you have confirmed that. You've confirmed that effectively with your own verbalized grammar. So a lot of the time, a sovereign citizen will not refer to themselves by their name. Instead, they might verbalize that their name is David colon Jones, or David the son of Jones. They might add parentheses or quotation marks around their name, or differentiate their name in some way of not confirming their quote government name grammatically. During court appearances and traffic stops, phrases like, "Oh, I am not David Jones, I am the person existing and traveling the earth who is hitherto referred to as David Jones." SOVSITs will say that in any legal interaction that they have with a government employee, your legal phrasing has to be perfect, or else you will submit to a social contract. I'll post a link to some videos of sovereign citizens and their interactions with the law in the description to this episode. They are the kind of rabbit hole videos that once you watch one, you ultimately just want to see more, and eventually lose an entire Saturday to them. After the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, United States federal law enforcement began cracking down on white supremacist groups. And this included, you guessed it, the Sovereign Citizen Movement. Fun fact, Terry Nichols, one of the two conspirators who planted the Oklahoma City bomb, was actually a sovereign citizen himself. The Oklahoma City bombing led Congress to pass the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, thus enhancing sentences for certain terrorism-related offences. Thousands of sovereign citizens have been imprisoned due to their actions. Many continue their activities from behind bars, often spreading their ideologies among other inmates. As I said previously, the theories and methods of sovereign citizens have never worked against law enforcement, the government, or in United States courts. Yet they continue to try. The same applies in the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia, where sovereign citizens have never been successful legally. The Southern Poverty Law Center published a report in 2010 following almost 12 months of in-depth research into the sovereign citizen movement. The SPLC estimated that around 100,000 American citizens considered themselves to be, quote, hardcore sovereign believers. An additional 200,000 US citizens were estimated to be, quote, just starting out by testing sovereign techniques for resisting everything from speeding tickets to drug charges, unquote. The number of sovereign citizen militia groups in the United States increased dramatically between 2008 and 2011, from 149 to 1,274. Followers of the sovereign citizen movement often share ideologies and beliefs with members of the QAnon movement. A sovereign citizen group known as the Oath Enforcers attracted QAnon and Donald Trump supporters into their movement after the 2021 storming of the United States Capitol. A prominent figure in the SovSit movement is a gentleman named David Miller. Miller invented something known as quantum grammar. This is specific phraseology to use in courtrooms to get the exact results that you want, apparently. Examples of quantum grammar include notions like, quote, only nouns matter. It's important to use as few adjectives or verbs as you can during defense speech. This is because adjectives and verbs don't exist legally, for some reason. Further, every sentence which you say to law enforcement or in court needs to be at least 13 words in length. And of all the more than 2 million words in the English language, only 720 words are allegedly legitimate syntax, according to their theories of law at least. By the way, David Miller also self-proclaims himself as the King of Hawaii. He was able to do this, he said, because he turned the word Hawaii into a verb. Again, whatever the hell that means. Russell Gold, another well-known SovSit, made claim to becoming the Postmaster General of the United States. He did this by allegedly filing paperwork in the correct way. SovSits pull excerpts from the Bible. They'll pull wording from the British Magna Carta. They'll even pull pieces of the United States Constitution, taken out of context, of course, and leaving out the parts that they don't like, such as the 14th Amendment. But it all makes clear sense to them. They have outsmarted the government and everyone else. They are onto a secret that no one else knows, and they have all the answers. It's a kind of arrogant, cult-like groupthink. On Thursday, May 20th, 2010, at around 11:36 a.m., two police officers in West Memphis, Arkansas, were shot and killed during a routine traffic stop. A white Plymouth Voyager minivan was traveling east on Interstate 40 towards Airport Road. The minivan was pulled over by police officer Bill Evans. Officer Evans was running drug searches and interception stops at the time. Because the minivan had out-of-state Ohio license plates, Officer Evans chose it for a random stop and search. Sergeant Brandon Powdert immediately supported and joined Officer Evans at the scene. Traveling in the minivan was father and son duo 45-year-old Jerry R. Kane, Jr. and his 16-year-old son Joseph Kane. Jerry Kane was a staunch sovereign citizen. He did not have a driver's license, and his minivan was not legally registered. He also happened to have a brick of marijuana in his vehicle. If that wasn't enough to justify the police stopping him, it also transpired that Kane also had two arrest warrants out for him, one in Ohio and one in New Mexico. Sergeant Powdert arrived at the scene, so then Officer Evans attempted to frisk Jerry. Suddenly, Jerry turned and attacked Evans in a scuffle down an embankment into a ditch. Seeing his father in a violent confrontation with the police, Joseph Kane stepped out from the minivan from the passenger door, wielding an AK-47. Joe opened fire, spraying a hail of bullets. Sergeant Powdert ran to the rear of Officer Evans' police car and returned fire with three shots from his .40 caliber Glock 22 handgun. He fired through the windows of Evans' car in an attempt to hit Joe on the other side of the vehicle. Sergeant Powdert fired just four more times at Joe, but each bullet missed its target. Joe then sprayed a burst of shots through the hood of the police car, striking Sergeant Powdert in the head with a ricochet. Both officers were fatally wounded. Sergeant Powdert died at the scene just a few moments later. Evans was transported to hospital, although died upon arrival. Jerry and Joe Kane sped away from the scene in the minivan.
In the Memphis area, two police officers are shot and killed, a local sheriff and his chief deputy wounded, and the two suspects thought to be behind the shootouts dead. It started when two West Memphis, Arkansas police officers were shot during a traffic stop along a busy interstate highway. One of the officers, the son of the West Memphis police chief. Later, another shootout in a Walmart parking lot. Two members of the sheriff's department wounded here. They shot at the suspects. Suspects in a white van with Ohio plates. It is not known why the officers pulled over the van in the first place. Lee Powell, the Associated Press.
Vincent Brown, a FedEx driver from Houston, Texas, witnessed the shooting and called 911. Neither officer could make an officer down call due to their fatal injuries.
911, where is your emergency?
Exit 275 on 40. These guys just shot a police officer. Please hurry.
Approximately 2 hours after the incident, Crittenden County Sheriff Dick Busby and Chief Enforcement Officer W.A. Wren stopped a minivan believed to be the suspect in a Walmart car park. Busby and Wren were wounded in gunfire, which they exchanged with the suspects, who opened fire on the police once again. Both Jerry and Joe Kane were killed during the firefight. Dozens of officers surrounded the minivan during the gunfight. Teenager Joe Kane was shot to death by police. Jerry Kane ran a debt elimination business from his home in Ohio, and he traveled the country giving seminars and advice on methods of, quote, forestalling foreclosures. Money and home loans are fictitious, he lectured. Any U.S. citizen can simply sign a quit claim deed to obtain full ownership of their homes, mortgage-free. Jerry vehemently supported the redemption movement. It was triggered by the death of his daughter when she was just 6 weeks old. She died from sudden infant death syndrome, and an autopsy was performed against his wishes. This seriously angered Jerry. He grew massively distrustful of the authorities. Up until this point in the late 1990s, Jerry had worked as a truck driver, but he gave this up and denounced his own driver's license in protest of the government. He gradually became more and more antagonistic towards Ohio law enforcement. Kane complained in 2004 that he had been enslaved by a judge who had sentenced him to serve 6 days of community service for driving with an expired license plate and no seatbelt. This was the straw that broke the camel's back for Jerry, and he descended into full-blown sovsit. After the shootout, the sheriff's office in West Memphis announced that Sergeant Brandon Pudert was shot 14 times by Joe Kane, and Officer Bill Evans was shot 8 times. In the later police takedown, Jerry Kane was shot 18 times by police, and Joe Kane was shot 8 times. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.